We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Every year in this country, we spend tens of billions of dollars on health care for people in the final weeks of their lives. And we do it even though that it doesn't always help. It doesn't help most people live longer or even better. This morning in this hour, we'll be talking about palliative care and hospice for the terminally ill and also for their families, for the people who are close to them. And our guest for the program is Dr. Martha Twaddle. She is the Chief Medical Officer at the Midwest Palliative and Hospice Care Center. That's located in Glenview, Illinois. And she is a nationally recognized expert in hospice and palliative medicine. In addition to her association with the Palliative and Hospice Care Center, she is the Associate Program Director for Hospice and Palliative Medicine at Rush University Medical Center. She is an Associate Professor of Medicine at Rush Medical College, and she's also a lecturer at Northwestern University at the Feinberg School of Medicine. And she has been working in this area for quite a while. And we're pleased that she could spend some time talking with us as we try to look basically at how it is we think about end of life, how it is we deal with that time, and what it is we try to do for not only for the person who is making their way towards the end of their life, but also what kind of support and services are provided for people's families as they go on that journey along with their loved one. Questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. In addition, we have email if you want to join us that way. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. And any way you do it, we certainly welcome questions. We do hope people please will be brief. Stay on the topic for us. That'll help, and that'll also help us accommodate as many different people as are interested in being involved in the conversation. And Dr. Twaddle, hello.
Well, thank you so much. Happy Friday, and it's a real pleasure to be with you this morning.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. I think it may be not the easiest thing to talk about, but I think it's a good thing to be talking about. And, you know, I also feel whenever we have talk about this topic, I think we often do what I did right at the beginning and start to talk about money, start to talk about the cost of care. And you have to say, well, that is something that needs to be discussed. But I think also what we want to talk about or encourage people to think about also is quality of life. And that is whatever it is you decide to do, what really does it do for the person? And does it make their last days better or not? And I'm not sure that we focus as much on that as maybe we should.
Well, I think in this day and age, we certainly have to be thinking about the resources that we're allocating. And to me, it's about the talk of finances. We know we need to spend the money, but let's spend the money in ways that are meaningful to the person receiving the care. And I think what we're really suffering from in this country in terms of finances is a mismatch of the use of resources with what the patient and family really find meaningful. And we know that technology can be very appropriate per se to the situation, but may not constitute relief of suffering, may actually become the source of suffering. And so we do want to focus on a patient family's quality of life. This is a place in their lives where it matters more than ever before. I often say to my team members, you know, this isn't to discount the sales world, but this isn't retail. People don't get to come back and say, you know, I really didn't like the way the last year of my life went, and I didn't think my death was good. Could I do it again? We don't have that option. We've got to do it right. And what we're also learning in this field that I find particularly compelling is we're actually seeing data now a lot through work of a very phenomenal colleague, Nick Christakis, now at Harvard, is that a good death is, in essence, the ultimate preventative medicine. What we're able to see is that when a spouse loses their loved one or a family member loses their loved one in hospice care, they are less likely to become ill and die themselves in the subsequent months and years if they've had that support, as compared to match controls who don't use hospice.
Mm-hmm.
So this has tremendous public health implications. It's not just about that person and their quality of life. It has to do with who moves on after that event.
Well, and I think here, I'm sure one of the points that you want to make is that palliative care, it's not just for the person who happens to be dying. The idea is that what you do is you're involving family members, you're developing a kind of a plan that not only addresses the needs of the person who is dying, but you're addressing the needs of the whole family.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, what's been very exciting in this whole field of medicine is that hospice entered this country about 1978. It was a grassroots effort entered through the Connecticut Hospice Project in response to people's needs, that patients and families were really suffering and that death was not well supported, and the aftermath of death, the survivors' lives, was not well supported. And so hospice just took off and grew. And in the early 1990s, a group of us at Northwestern felt very strongly that this robust, phenomenal type of care needed to become part of the very fabric of our health care. That it didn't need to be an alternative, so to speak. It needed to be part of healthcare, and that healthcare, the way our physicians are trained, our nurses practice, needed to shift away from the overemphasis on intervention and technology back to really the basics of we're taking care of people in the context of their family, their communities. We need to focus on them. And from that work, we developed really the growth and expansion of palliative care. And palliative care is like hospice in that it is very much about the family. The patient is the core. It's about body, mind, and spirit. It's about symptom management, goals of care. But it's not limited just to the end of life. Palliative care, using that team-based, interdisciplinary team approach, has vital application for any patient and their family that has received a diagnosis that is life-changing. And that diagnosis may be limited in the sense that they may recover and re-enter life, perhaps changed, more often than not changed, but with a good prognosis. But we have seen that using the same tools of hospice that we can really help serious illness. And like you said, it's not just about the patient. It's about the people that journey with that patient and taking care of them as well.
Mm-hmm. Something that I think that we wanted to try to talk about, and recently in some reading that we've done on this, there seems to be the suggestion that if you take a look at some of the things that are done for people who are very, very seriously ill and who we know are at the end of their lives, they may be weeks or months from the end of their lives, that some of the treatments that they receive, not only do they not extend that person's life, they're not going to cure the problem, they're not going to help them live longer, they may, in fact, feel worse for that treatment. And that really doesn't make sense.
Well, and that's very true. And a lot of it has to do with the type of communication that happens around illness. And obviously, if we could have more time to communicate and more opportunities for the primary care physicians of this country to really work through some of anticipation of knowing that this is the diagnosis that you have, let's talk about what that means to you and your family, how you would define quality of life given this diagnosis, and what types of treatments you would find beneficial. And I, you know, as your physician, I'll take the time to explain what those treatments are and what they lead to. If we could have those opportunities beforehand, we'd probably find ourselves less in a crisis intervention mode. But our healthcare system is really, again, it's mismatched for those with chronic illness and those with advanced illness, and it's certainly mismatched for those that are in the dying phases of their life, because our healthcare system is about acute care and intervention, like you're saying, rescue mentality. Well, you don't rescue people from diabetes or chronic lung disease or heart disease or multiple sclerosis. You support them, and the goal is to help them to live well and long. And palliate means to support and protect and enshroud, to really help someone through the experience of being ill, with the goal that they experience quality of life, relief of symptoms that are distressing, and those symptoms might not just be physical. They might be psychological and spiritual and social symptoms. And that's a different mindset than our current healthcare system is poised to deliver.
Well, when you look at the subject of diagnosis, particularly when it comes to terminal illness, how much room is there for interpretation? I'm struggling with how to talk about this. Say you're a physician and you have someone who has cancer, or they have something else that you know that person is going to die. You can't tell them what day it's going to be.
Yeah.
And it may be very difficult even to say you have 3 weeks, you have 2 months, you have 6 months, and you can talk to them about what it is you can do. I guess I'm wondering just how much precision, how much certainty you can give to the patient about what the prognosis is, and then if it's very uncertain, how that uncertainty influences then how the person and their family think about, well, what are we going to do?
That's right. And, you know, the skill sets within palliative care and the goal, and just as a little side, the goal of palliative care becoming a specialty is to further enhance and support every physician practicing primary palliative care. It's not just about a specialist doing this. Right now, there's a big specialty effort, but the goal is that we educate and reinfuse medical training to enhance the skill sets, particularly around communication and mentoring decision-making for patients and families. So the physician with a knowledge of disease process, diagnostics, and okay, we've made this diagnosis, and what does that mean? What's the natural history of this disease? So let's say I'm sitting down with a patient who has pulmonary disease. They've been diagnosed with emphysema. And let's say it's fairly early and they're not on oxygen and they still have a high functional level. Well, we talk in terms of that. I say to them, you know, the typical history with this illness is it is progressive, and it will begin at some point to change your ability to function and to live independently. As it progresses, you may become very reliant on oxygen around the clock. And when we see things like weight loss and changes in energy level and even confusion, that tells us we're entering a different phase of your disease. The one thing I'm always very mindful to share with patients is people write their own story. You know, our data about prognosis and all those things are population retrospective analysis, but every person is an individual. And as a physician, I'd be arrogant, I think, to ascribe that you have 6 months. You know, I don't know that. I can say based on the typical course of this illness, we need to think in terms of months. We need to think in terms of weeks to months. In some cases, I'm talking to patients, we need to think in terms of days to weeks. I'm having those conversations. But I say to them, you're going to write your own story. And what we do know is that with good supportive care, support for you and your family, body, mind, and spirit, the data is strongly suggestive that you will live longer and better. The thing that's fascinating to me is that there are studies out there that now suggest that when a patient utilizes hospice care, regardless of their diagnosis, they live longer than if they didn't use hospice. Now, we haven't done that same thing for palliative care. So imagine the palliative care team getting involved when you're first diagnosed with cancer, as you start chemo. It will be very interesting to look at those patients to see if they live longer and better than those who don't use palliative care, even before we get to the world of hospice.
And you think that has something to do with the fact that maybe you're giving them more support, a little bit more assurance. Maybe they have a little bit more feeling of control. Maybe some of the many stressors involved are reduced somewhat, and that it just overall makes that person's life a little easier. It changes their outlook, and that makes a difference in how the disease progresses.
It's very much a global experience for that patient and family. I'm sure at a physiologic level, knowing that there is a team that is very much committed to their well-being will lower their stress, and that stress physiologically would be the stress hormones, their cortisol levels, their depression. Those things would be improved upon, and we know that that high cortisol and stress levels has a very negative effect on the body over time. It depletes us, not just in terms of emotional response, but in terms of physiologic response. And knowing that family is getting support also helps relieve some of the anxiety. Families spend a lot of time during severe illness trying to protect each other. They are fearful oftentimes of talking about what if this happens, what if that happens, and that anxiety and fear eats away at all of them. Mm-hmm. Sleep becomes disrupted, appetite, overall well-being, and that can influence then how well someone can weather treatments and certainly how long they're going to live. So these are the things that are exciting for us in this field to perhaps study with some scientific rigor. How does this affect? It's tough because we're not looking just at the physical. We're looking at the psychological and spiritual and social aspects of patients and their families.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Dr. Martha Twaddle. She is the Chief Medical Officer at the Midwest Palliative and Hospice Care Center in Glenview. She is also Associate Program Director for Hospice and Palliative Medicine at Rush University Medical Center, where she is Associate Professor, she is also Associate Professor of Medicine at Rush Medical College. And we're talking this morning about palliative care and hospice. And kind of questions, welcome. Maybe someone has an experience they would want to relate. That could be very helpful. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. And also, you may email your comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. When I hear the word palliative, I guess the thing that I think of is pain relief. And I know, in fact, at your center there, you work with people who have persistent pain. So it's not just people who are terminally ill. And it seems to me, I think about what has been said about what people, as they approach the end of their lives, what they're really afraid of. And that it seems that a lot of people say, well, I'm not really afraid of dying. It's the manner. It's what I'm going to have to go through. And it's being in really severe pain. That's the thing that concerns me. And I'm sure that people who work in hospice and who do what you do would say, well, there's no reason for people to have bad pain. We can deal with that. I wonder how well now that we are actually communicating to people that that's available and that we actually do that.
You know, it is at times discouraging to look at the statistics, even in big studies recently done, that we're still seeing more than 50% of folks who are in the last days of their life experiencing moderate to severe pain without relief. Now, those studies were primarily study groups within hospitals, so patients receiving interventions, and yet we're doing a better job, I think, of assessing and documenting pain, and I think we've made some strides in terms of the relief of pain, but we've got a long way to go. And I'm very excited with the outcomes that we have in terms of successful alleviation of pain and other symptoms, because most people, as their disease advances, they have multiple symptoms. Pain is a biggie, and probably more than 75% of people have some aspect of pain, but there's also shortness of breath and nausea and weakness and headaches. You know, just it goes on and on and on. Itching, coughing, and all those things can distract and detract from the ability to really live well. Cicely Saunders, who's the founder of the hospice movement, says that pain nails you to your body. it's impossible to really transcend and be interactive with your family in a deep way when every breath you take just brings you back to your physical limitations and is so distracting. There's so much we can do to treat pain nowadays. There are effective medications, but there's also the awareness that pain is not just a physical experience. Pain, as Saunders described it, there's something called total pain. People can have social pain and spiritual pain and psychological pain, and because they're an integrated, dynamic person, all those things can be part of their pain experience. And if we're not attending to them as people and looking at them very holistically, we might overemphasize one type of intervention for them as far as pain control versus another. So I can think of many of my patients, their faces go before my eyes even now, of where we've coupled the medicinal approach to pain control with physical therapy and physical modalities of massage, maybe acupuncture, maybe TENS, maybe exercise when they can do it. And it's amazing what people can do as far as what exercise constitutes. And we couple that also with the psychological and spiritual support that they need, because having persistent pain can really impact not just that patient, but their whole family system. It's a challenging symptom, but we've got good success with it. We really do.
Well, we have several callers to bring into the conversation. Let's
Wonderful.
Do that. We'll take them right in the order they came in, and we'll start with line one, and this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning. Am I on?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, hi, and thanks for having me on. Interesting topic and guest. My question is with regards to pushback from people who are concerned about the ethics and, you know, people with strong religious convictions about, you know, the slippery slope to euthanasia, et cetera. Have you experienced any pushback where you worked from elements in the, you know, from colleagues or nurses, social workers who are very opposed to, who see it as hastening death and who, you know, they kind of talk about how you should fight and be a fighter, and we believe in miracles, and how do you communicate with those families, and how do you talk about futility to them?
Well, those are great topics.
To them, and what kind of pushback have you experienced?
And certainly early in my career in 1989 when I started in this field, I experienced a lot more pushback than I do now. And I think part of it is just people's preconceived notions of what it is that we're talking about. And you know, hospice as a philosophy and then as a program, if you've seen one hospice, you've seen one hospice. It's a sad state, even though perhaps we are all Medicare certified. The way people interpret the interventions of hospice care and maybe even palliative care will vary, and the customer has to be savvy as to who they're working with. Hospice is really about living, and I'm not just being trite. It is about living well and living large in the time that you have. The effort is about controlling symptoms and supporting the family so that that patient can live until they die. So there's no incentive or goal that the end come faster. The incentive is actually that they live well and as long as possible. And even financially, if I can digress to that, hospices benefit from their patients living longer than they do if their patients come and die fast. And certainly because it's staffed by healthcare folks who in their deepest roots really want to help people, they celebrate the improvements. And you see lots of enthusiasm in the charting, as I audited, of when people show any signs of improvement. Nowadays, 70% of patients who use hospice care don't have cancer. And there's a significant proportion, it's small, but there's a steady proportion of patients who actually graduate back out of hospice. They get better enough to stop hospice care. So the slippery slope to euthanasia, I think, is a misunderstanding of what hospice is about and is probably informed by kind of a limited experience, perhaps a patient who came in who was imminently dying and died, and people looking for answers. Well, why did they die so fast? When in actuality, they were in the dying event, and it just happened in hospice. There are many patients, and equal and more, who come in and thrive and live much longer than expected. And the other thing I would say is, you know what, it's not mutually exclusive to be in hospice and hope for miracles. And it's not mutually exclusive to be in hospice and to continue to fight. You can honor someone's goals, and you can define what it means to fight and to hope. There is no reason not to continue that. Now, if fighting, as we talked about earlier in this program, are interventions that are actually hurtful, then we have an opportunity to talk about those things and say, hey, you know what, let's not keep beating ourselves against the wall when we're actually risking shortening our life. Let's align the resources and the interventions to honor the life that we have. And if things go well and we get better, there's more people at the party. If things don't go well and death is the outcome, there's support, there's a safety net, there's help for those who are going to survive. And it really is about living and living well.
All right, well, I want to thank the caller. Let's go to someone here next, somebody on cell phone on our line 3 right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I have an injured nerve. I'm not really a hospice candidate, but one thing I found is that, I have severe pain, and I've had to really advocate for myself to get the medication I need other than rely on, healthcare professionals to prescribe. And I was just curious as to her experience of dealing with individuals with severe pain.
Yeah. We in this country, our whole treatment of pain and pain as a cultural response is just so frustrating to me in my career. And I've watched it go up and down. I've watched acceptance and progress as far as integrative pain treatments and approval and more access to medications and treatments that improve pain, and then I've seen it slip back through reactions of the DEA, et cetera. Unfortunately, pain is a topic that generates lots of response from regulatory bodies as well as medical bodies, and I don't think that we are yet at a place where we have good, consistent treatment of pain in all its aspects. And palliative care can play a role. We do see comprehensive pain clinics that combine the psychological support, spiritual and physical support with the medications. But you're absolutely right. They are few and far between. And as a patient, no matter what your problem is, in our current system, we have to be advocates, and it's tough because the sicker we are, the harder it is to advocate for ourselves.
Yes, so, I think I'm fortunate in that I am educated, and I am a researcher to a certain degree, and, I was able to actually go out and research and then, try to develop a team that would, work with me to find medications that would work. And, I had to take numerous medications and, they didn't work and try other ones. But mm-hmm. I just, feel also I live in a rural area close to Champaign, and I find it hard to find a complete, program of, like the psychological support. But I thank you for your interest. I really do.
All right.
Yeah,
well, thank
and
you.
Passionate support of my colleagues who work in that area. The American Pain Foundation, the American Pain Society are good groups to access information from as far as advocacy, because there's lots of work to be done.
And I think this raises an important point. In a sense, it's another issue with something that we've talked about before, that while it's true that in this country we have a serious problem with abuse of prescription medications, at the same time, we have people who do have serious persistent pain problems, and there are people who can use these powerful medications, use them responsibly, not have a problem with them, get relief from their pain, and it makes it possible for those people to have a life that otherwise they would not have.
Absolutely. Continue to function, continue to work, really thrive. And unless we really support that, and what the caller just said, which I find wonderful that he's been able to do, but also it's in somewhat discouraging is he had to create that team himself, you know, find the people and make his own team, as opposed to the healthcare system being focused on that patient and their family and responding with the team structure necessary to improve his condition. And that's what, quite honestly, we hope in healthcare, those of us who work in the field of palliative care, who work in pain medicine, we are working all the time on a higher level to try to adjust our systems so that they are more responsive to patient and family-centered care.
Mm-hmm. We are a little bit past our midpoint. I have two other calls we get right to, but for anybody who has just joined us, I want to introduce again the guest, Dr. Martha Twaddle. She's the Chief Medical Officer at the Midwest Palliative and Hospice Care Center in Glenview, Illinois. She is also Associate Program Director for Hospice and Palliative Medicine at Rush University Medical Center. She is Associate Professor of Medicine at Rush Medical College and also is a lecturer at Northwestern University at the Feinberg School of Medicine there. And she has been working in the area of hospice and palliative medicine for a long time. Questions are welcome as we continue to talk about the issues involved in end of life and also taking care of people who have persistent and chronic pain. Both of those things they do there at the center where she works. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. And next we'll talk with someone in Champaign on line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I had two sisters who died of cancer, and my mother died of cancer. Mm-hmm. My mother and my baby sister fortunately got hospice care, but my twin sister did not because there was no hospice in Texas in 1979. Mm-hmm. But she did have a group for terminally ill people, and they gave her a lot of support, but of course the group began to diminish until she was the last one.
Oh, wow.
The other thing I wanted to say is that families just can't do everything. Mm. I remember how hard it was. My sister was ill for 4 years, and I was a major blood donor because she needed blood just like hers, and since we were identical twins, I was giving blood all the time. And I was also teaching and going to graduate school. And it is very difficult to do something like that over a period of years. And we didn't get a lot of support. It's sort of like, well, you just do it, you know?
Yeah.
And we did, but it was hard. And that was all I wanted to say.
I am so glad you called in.
Oh, thank you.
It really, an opportunity to hear on a radio to say bless you for, I mean, really giving body and soul to your family members and the love that you showed and actualized. I mean, what a powerful demonstration of caregiving, that you're not just physically caring, but you're actually giving your blood to your sister.
And you know, I was going to give 4 quarts of bone marrow, but she decided she didn't want to do that.
And you really do highlight that it's just not just the patient making this journey. It's the family around them. And the support systems required are much greater than just a physician and a patient interacting. That's why this type of care is based on a team, involves social workers and chaplains and nurses and volunteers. Because it takes a village. It really does.
It does.
And, but, you know, I'm so grateful you called in. That is just an incredible inspiration to hear that, and that you were able to do that for your family.
Can I say one more thing,
sure,
please?
Sure.
I have fibromyalgia, and it took 5 years for me to get something for my chronic pain. Mm. Fortunately, I have it now.
And that has been a journey, hasn't it, with fibromyalgia?
Oh, yes.
Just the whole understanding of medical science that, yes, it really is a condition, and yes, it's real, and yes, it requires certain types of treatment. I remember the evolution of that, having been in medicine now for over 25 years. I certainly knew that it was real in my patients, and took a while for the science to catch up with the experience of the person.
I had never even heard of it until I was diagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's all I called for. Thank you.
Well, thank you
for
the call.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Let me go on here to some other callers. And again, we're coming into about our last 15 minutes. We'll try to get in as many as we can. And next, talk with someone in Urbana, and that would be on our line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
My question pertains to the regulatory agencies and the politics of pain control and opiate medication prescribing. It seems like periodically something happens, and all the doctors in the Champaign-Urbana area start reducing the doses of their patients' chronic pain medication. There's like these efforts at opiate reduction or something. Have you experienced any kind of political, or do they prosecute a doctor? What triggers these fears for prescribing the opiates for pain?
You are absolutely
politically
right.
Linked at all, or is district attorneys going after somebody? I don't understand.
It is very cyclical. It typically comes after there's been some sort of publication. If you recall, it was in the last few years we saw something in Time magazine. There was something in the New York Times about a physician who'd gone to prison for prescribing medications. Increased scrutiny, increased activity from the DEA. Now, there is an issue going on because the numbers of toxic reports, okay, so toxicity defined as death related to an opioid medication, have grown exponentially in this country. And it comes from a lack of good education to these prescribing physicians. They are not well educated in how to use these meds, how to titrate them, how to monitor them, and they want to take good care of their patients, but they don't know well how to use the tools. Now, one of the answers to that, and from a social activism, would be to require physicians, as they get their, we have to have a certain number of continuing medical education credits to get our license renewed. A certain portion of those should be related to pain management. That's what they did in California, and it was extremely effective. There are resources for us to learn how to use these medications effectively. There's a course through the American Pain Foundation called Safe Prescribing. We can use these medications effectively and safely and see our patients benefit, and it's just an opportunity to educate. So if we get our energies around promoting that and putting things in place so that the regulatory bodies help us, not hurt us, I think a lot more people will have relief.
Yeah. Well, may I make a comment?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what I've seen happen here in my community is that, when this opiate reduction campaign began, everybody I know, people who had opiates for chronic migraines, all the opiate people are getting their doses reduced. All that happened was the black market flourished.
Yeah.
Buying the stuff on the street at inflated prices, and the whole criminality of it increased. And whatever the government or the police or the politicians are trying to accomplish, it just backfires in the community and in the street.
We're very fortunate in Illinois that the people who work in pain management and the regulatory bodies are more often than not pharmacists, and they're educated. Other states in this country, they may be not, and this is not to discount the police force, but they may not have any direct education in what these medications are really about and what they're for. And you're absolutely right that the misuse of a few hurts those who need the medications and who benefit from them. And that's always true, isn't it? But again, I think if we work on educating our physicians on how to document, how to prescribe, how to practice safe prescribing, these societal issues would not so radically affect what's delivered to the patient.
Thanks to the call. Let's go on, and we'll talk with someone next in Champaign, and this is line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Uh-huh. I'm speaking towards my experiences, my life experiences. I'm familiar with hospice care in that I worked for home infusion about 10 years ago. So I'm familiar with the restrictions of hospice and requirements as far as what you can treat with and what you can't. My experience with palliative care came through journeying with my husband and treating his mother's terminal illness in a hospital in Omaha. And it seems to me that her oncologist was not willing to give up, and maybe all oncologists are kind of bred to be this way, to fight to the very end. But it really wasn't until my brother-in-law just found a little brochure sitting on a table at the hospital about palliative care. And it seemed like, you know, wow, this is what we really need right now. And so he initiated introducing palliative care. And once that came into play, things just really seemed to be better for the family. Nobody was in denial anymore. And I was wondering, you kind of started to speak to the education, but, I mean, is palliative care an opportunity for the team to – how well do they mix with the oncology team and, you know,
so palliative care? Palliative care has a role in for any patient and family who are confronted with serious illness, a life-changing diagnosis, a serious diagnosis. There is a role to bring in supportive care. And we have made huge efforts in this field to grow this discipline. In some ways, I kind of smile because I'm a trained internist. I went into primary care medicine, and what I do as a palliative care specialist is really what I thought the primary physician was going to do. You know, that's what I thought I would do as a primary care physician. And our system, again, our healthcare system, has driven it such that our primary care physicians don't really get to leave their office. They can't afford to. They don't have time to. There's little reimbursement for the time spent with families as you discuss these things. And so palliative care as a specialty is trying to grow in response to this and train people so that, like your brother discovered, a brochure in a hospital, we have hospital-based palliative care programs at more than 75% of teaching hospitals in this country now. We've seen exponential growth in the services of palliative care, particularly within hospitals. That's been our effort through what's called the Center for Advancement of Palliative Care, CAPC, CAPC. And you can look at their website and see a lot of the activity around palliative care. The next great frontier, I think, though, is people shouldn't have to just get to the hospital to get this kind of supportive care. They should be able to access it in their doctor visits, in their home setting, if they live in a nursing home, because we want more stories like yours, that everything got better. And that's really, that is so important. So as you journey, you're the patient or you're the family member, you're making that journey, you've got people to help you, and that's so critical.
Well, I thank you for your efforts and your continued efforts to help educate and change our healthcare system.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. On to Bloomington for another caller. Line 4. Hello.
Well, hello. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could address some of the causes of racial disparities in hospice and any methods of overcoming that.
Racial disparities, a great, great topic. You know, for a long time, particularly because of its history, hospice was considered a place for kind of the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant to get care. And we've been able to demonstrate that by increasing cultural competence of our caregivers and really morphing the care plan to serve the patient and family, again, to be patient and family-centered, we can change supportive care to really meet their needs. And when you look at the National Consensus Project of Quality Palliative Care, what you'll see in that, so what this is on the web, it's a document that sets forth what are considered the essential elements of quality care and what has to happen in order to say you're doing palliative care. And one of the key domains is cultural. So assessing the culture of that family, their ethnic background, their religious background, how they make decisions as a family, paying attention to that as part of the history taking so that then care that's delivered is sensitive to how that family wants care delivered. So let me give you an example. I got called one day for a consultation on an 89-year-old woman who had a new diagnosis of lung cancer that was fairly far advanced. And on her intake form, our team, which is sensitive right away to ask certain questions, had written down Mandarin Chinese. Okay, so she's Chinese, she speaks Mandarin. And what that tells me through not generalization, but to be sensitive to ask, is that knowing that many Asian Americans or Asian first generation they make decisions differently than the typical Western ethic of full disclosure. What do you want? Right. So the first question I ask when I walk in that room is I say to the oldest family member, child, how does your family make health care decisions, and what kind of discussion should we have today? So from the very get-go is to have a sense of what might be at play, and then to ask that family. You know, the risk in cultural competency is to take that and generalize and assume. We want to have a sensitivity. We want to ask questions, and we want to work within the system that meets that family's needs. And when we do that, the care looks different for different families, and that's okay.
Do you think it's mostly an issue of education, of getting
absolutely.
To the table? You mentioned once you've gotten them in the project, but how do you get people interested in actually doing palliative care and not saying that doing palliative care is giving up?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, back in the early 1990s when we started on this effort, one of the reasons that we started palliative care, hospice and palliative medicine being the name of the specialty, become a specialty, mm-hmm. is because when we're a specialty in medicine, that means that every medical student has to spend time with us. Mm-hmm. That means that every board exam for all the specialties from surgery to neurosurgery to oncology contains questions from our curriculum. That means that every primary care physician has competencies within our field that must be met. And as we improve the education of our providers, they will have more fluency in this work. And likewise, there's a tremendous amount of public education, just like this radio program, so that we can advocate for what it is we need as people, for our family members, for ourselves, for those people that we love.
Thank you very much.
Right, thank you. Mm-hmm. We just have a couple of minutes left, and I had an email here. Maybe you can at least respond in some part. As no doubt the person is thinking about how some of these questions came up in the recent conversation about healthcare in this country and the need to provide healthcare for people that don't have it. And the person is asking, well, how do you respond to all the recent talk about rationing of medical care and whether or not it's possible to avoid something that might be called rationing?
You know, the sad thing is we're already rationing healthcare. We're already allowing some people who have other means to get healthcare that other people who don't have means, who don't have insurance, can't get healthcare. So let's not pretend that we haven't been rationing. What we really need to do as a country and what we're working diligently on is to better align the resources that we have with the care that is meaningful. Now, I'll be real honest with you that we worked hard to establish support and reimbursement for physicians to have adequate time to talk to their patients and their families about their goals of care. Right now a physician has no means to receive reimbursement to extend that appointment such that they can sit with a patient and their family and talk about what do you want when. The reimbursement doesn't cover the cost of their time. So that was the effort that was made in the early initiatives around healthcare reform. And I won't use names, but somebody in politics decided to call that a death panel and decided to say that we were going to kill grandma. That was not the intent of that legislation. And all that stuff got taken out of healthcare reform. So we're back, you know, back to figuring out how we can get reimbursement aligned with what it is that patients and families need. We need the public to say, we need time with our doctors, and we want our doctors supported for taking that time with us. It's critical for all our well-being.
One big issue that I really can't give you enough time to respond to, but I want to at least touch on it here at the end. I think a lot of people say one of the big obstacles always has been that it's not easy for people to accept the idea that they're going to die, that their mom and dads are going to die, that their kids are going to, you know, that eventually everybody's going to die. And I wonder whether you think that's gotten any easier.
Well, I don't think, you know, we make that the barrier sometimes to accessing supportive care. You have to acknowledge that you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
It is a dance, and some people can never quite go there, and some people have gone there, but they're afraid to say it. Why don't we focus on the fact that they need the care? And their families need the care, and they're going to write their own story, and let's make this journey together and see what happens. So rather than saying, let's talk about the fact you're going to die, let's talk about the fact that you're living with a life-threatening, life-limiting illness. How do you want to live? And what do we need to plan for in case the bottom falls out of life and you die sooner than we hope?
Yeah.
Let's plan for that.
And I'm sure that there are good resources. There's information available for people who want to think about these things, particularly if you have internet access. Are there any particular places, organizations, resources that you think are good and that would be good places for people to start?
I would encourage them to go to the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization's website, NHPCO. They have lots of information about patient and families and information about hospice. And, of course, I'd encourage them to go to our website at Midwest Care Center. So it's at carecenter.org, as we have information like that as well.
Hmm. Just what was it that led you into this area of practice? I'm just curious.
You know, this has been my passion. I find that this is the alignment of who I am as a person with the practice of medicine. I love to take care of people in the sense of their holism and their families. So this, to me, is just an expression of what I love about medicine. And I love this area of medicine in particular because it's so intense, because there's not a lot of time for superficiality. We really dig down to what matters fast because we don't have the time to talk about stuff that doesn't matter.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. Our guest, Martha Twaddle, is the Chief Medical Officer at the Midwest Palliative and Hospice Care Center in Glenview, Illinois. And Dr. Twaddle, thanks very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for hosting me.